CJ Fritsch, the KB Evening News intern and our resident sports writer. I'm Zell Zellis Marchant, and you've been listening to a KB News in Depth.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted.
This is Cat Meow.
And this is Becky.
And we want to hang out with you.
The Development Committee will meet the third Wednesday of every month at 7 p.m.
We're traffic informed and
food motivated.
And we're seeking like-minded individuals who want to use their rad fundraising skills and talents to
support the station. Join us.
Join us.
KBOO has a tent set up at the Occupy ICE encampment in Southwest Portland, where we are broadcasting and webcasting live reports from the camp.
Protesters have created a community of resistance since June 17th to protest the deportation and separation of families by the U.S.
U.S. Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE.
ICE, check our website for a schedule of upcoming broadcasts and listen to our past interviews at kboo.fm/OccupyICE.
The time is 6 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Welcome to Labor Radio. I am your host, Michael Cathcart. Joining me in the studio today is the co-chair of the Portland chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, Olivia Catby Smith. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So just for folks out there who may not be familiar with DSA, or Olivia more specifically, you may recognize her from a number of articles in Willamette Week, or any number of different protest rallies or organizing meetings here in Portland, or more recently, if you were a Fox News viewer, you may recognize her name and her Twitter account. So just because, as always, time is not on our side, I would like to start off just by asking you about what is your definition of democratic socialism, and how do you think that it differs from other concepts such as communism or socialism more generally, or social democracy?
Sure. So I think democratic socialism means different things to different people, especially within DSA. We are a multi-tenancy organization, meaning that we don't have a party line. You know, we don't have a specific set of ideals that people are bound to. But to me, democratic socialism means a society run for the people, not to make profits. And a central aspect of that would be workers controlling the means and resources of production and how they're distributed. To me, that means dismantling the patriarchy. To me, that means, you know, a planned economy, a society that is run to enable the environment to thrive, not to destroy it.
Sounds good.
Yeah. And, you know, it also means basic needs are a part of our society. You know, we have free health care, free child care, free education. You know, our basic needs, free housing, our basic needs are met. We are taken care of by the society we live in. It is run for us. It is not run for profit.
Absolutely. That all sounds very good. So more specifically for the chapter that you are the co-chair of here in Portland, what would you say is the vision that Portland DSA is putting forward to make the city of Portland and the surrounding area more livable and more equitable for working people and just people in general?
Well, I think that we believe that no one should be too poor to live. And that is the case for an increasing number of people in our city. We have a lot of different efforts ongoing right now to combat that. Our Tax the Rich campaign is a big one we're doing right now.
Yeah.
We have a Housing Rights Caucus. We have a Labor Caucus. We have a Racial Justice Caucus. We recognize that all of these issues are interconnected. And our larger vision is to abolish profit. I mean, you know, what do we mean by profit? Obviously, in the traditional sense, in a workplace, you know, there are low-level workers, there are mid-level managers, and then there are the top executives and the owners that are getting rich off of other people's labor. But also in all these other sectors as well, in the housing sector, for example, you know, landlords and developers are getting rich off a basic human need. In the healthcare sector, pharmaceutical executives and insurance executives are getting rich off a basic human need. You know, oil executives are getting rich off destroying a basic human need.
Absolutely.
So, you know, all of these things are interconnected, and that is our larger vision, not only in Portland, but nationwide as well. And we have to articulate a national vision if we want things to really change at the local level, because there's only so much we can do at the local level.
Right. And, you know, DSA, for folks who may not fully have been aware, has grown exponentially over the last, I guess, year and a half, or really since the 2016 election. I have the numbers somewhere in front of me, but I know that the local Portland chapter has grown almost faster than almost any other chapter in the country, or at least as a percentage of the population of the city that we're mm-hmm. in here. But either way, you know, New York has somewhere over 3,000 members, I believe. And so you may have heard, folks out there listening may have heard of this organization and only really heard about it in the last couple of years. Folks may have also heard of people like Cornel West, Bernie Sanders, who claims to be a Democratic Socialist as well. And DSA did endorse Bernie Sanders in the 2016 campaign, I believe, right?
Yes.
Awesome. So, yeah, just going back to stuff more specifically here in Portland, would you say that things like rent control or, you know, complete public housing for anyone in need, are those things that are on the docket for DSA, and are those things that has been championed by anyone in City Hall, or would you say that you need to continue pushing to get folks, you know, such as Mayor Ted Wheeler or any of the city councilors to even give you or these ideas the time of day?
It's absolutely something that's on the docket for DSA to push. We have a lot of tenant organizers that are in our organization now who are driving that effort. And I know that Commissioner Hugh Daly championed that effort. We are just starting to establish a relationship with her. So I'm hopeful that we can push her left on a lot of things.
Yeah.
Because there is a lot of pushing to be done. I don't think Mayor Wheeler has been receptive at all to the things that we've been advocating for. I think that he has tried to perform as though he is receptive, but we can sort of see through that. We'll continue to push until we see change.
Yeah. And just sort of along those lines, obviously pressuring from outside of City Hall or outside of, you know, the halls of power is a great way to start. Does DSA see itself more though as an outside advocacy group, or an advocacy group across many fronts, or is the larger goal to get to a point where it is a potentially third party or maybe even a second party within the American political landscape?
Well, again, we are a multi-tenancy organization,
yeah.
So people have very different views on this. We have people who want to take over the Democratic Party. We have people who are completely disinterested in that, like myself. I believe that we should be working towards a mass working class socialist party. And we have people who aren't really sure, you know. We are right now an advocacy organization, an activist organization on many different fronts. And we're still kind of testing the waters because, you know, there's never really been a socialist movement this big in America before. So we don't really know what's going to work and what's not going to work.
Right.
We're still figuring it all out as we go.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously the last time we saw anything near this size within the United States was during another massive time of change, you know, in the 1930s, 1940s, during the Great Depression and the rebuilding from that. One thing that has happened over, I guess, the last, it's been about 80 years or so, is that the other side of the political spectrum, the right, has really solidified its power, not only, you know, control over the means of production and everything like that, but also over the media and sort of the dissemination of of what is what makes up collective thought within this country. Do you see, you know, DSA on a national scale has gotten a lot of coverage recently, and even yourself and the chapter here in Portland has gotten a fair amount of coverage. Would you say that the coverage you've received, you personally, your organization here in Portland and on a national scale, has been fair? Has it been balanced? Has it been, or how would you characterize it?
So it always seems like, especially here in Portland, they really want to make it about one individual.
Yeah.
When, you know, that's not the point at all.
Right.
That is the opposite of what socialism means.
Yeah.
I understand that, like, as a leader, and Emily as well, you know, we are sort of the face of the organization. I'm sitting here talking to you.
Right.
But, you know, we are more than just a person. We all want to be, we want to make ourselves replaceable, because mm-hmm. it's not us as the people, the individuals who matters. It's about the collective movement.
Right.
So I think mostly the coverage in Portland, the big Willamette Week article was, it was pretty good. I mean, there were some things they got wrong. For example, we did not organize the Burgerville Workers Union. We just showed up to support, along with many other groups. but it was a pretty good article, other than some inaccuracies like that. On a national level, it's been really interesting, especially given the big win by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who was endorsed by DSA, the New York chapter of DSA, because all of a sudden, all these major networks were falling over themselves to talk about democratic socialism. And it was really funny to see the MSNBC segment where they talked about it, and she was like, what is democratic socialism? It's not socialism. It's not communism. It has nothing to do with those things. Democratic socialists just want a nicer, gentler version of capitalism.
That's right. Yeah, I believe it was Joanne Reed who said that most reporters, political reporters in the country, the next day after the election, were taking a crash course in democratic socialism. And just along those lines, you know, yeah, obviously the mainstream media has not done a good job or any job of providing a clear understanding to the American people of what democratic socialism is. We saw that during the 2016 election. You know, people, the media did not fairly cover Bernie Sanders or even cover him at all. They did not do a great job of explaining what the overall concept of what his platform meant.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, once Alexandria won in New York, you saw Sean Hannity on Fox News put her her platform up there, and it was actually, you know, he was using it as a scare tactic, as you mentioned earlier, but it actually seemed like a pretty great ad campaign for her, or a ad for her campaign.
Yeah.
And then more recently, you yourself were mentioned on Fox News on a debate, you know, on Tucker Carlson's show, where he was debating with Cornel West about mm-hmm. the merits of democratic socialism. And it seems, you know, obviously not intentioned, but it seems like Fox News has almost given better coverage to democratic socialism than has MSNBC or CNN or any of the quote-unquote liberal media.
Absolutely. I think the liberal media has totally watered it down. You know, it's the same thing with the word progressive, which now means nothing.
Right.
Hillary Clinton completely called herself a progressive. Doesn't mean anything. I can see the same sort of trend happening with the words democratic socialism.
Right.
But yeah, it's interesting to see Fox News cover it so accurately, because they're using the things we want, or many of us want, like abolishing profit, like a world without borders, as a sort of like scare tactic. But it's like, yes, that is accurate. That is what we strive for.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, obviously it's a scare tactic, but for the uninitiated, for the viewer who is just looking at it fresh, it may not have seemed that bad. You know, the Fox News viewer, the average Fox News viewer, I believe, is somewhere over 70 years old. And one of the main platform points, at least when Sean Hannity put that up there for Alexandria in New York, was taking care of the elderly and fixing, you know, mm-hmm. Medicare, shoring up Medicare and things like that. And those things likely would play pretty well to the average Fox News viewer.
Absolutely.
Devoid of context. So just transitioning slightly, since you did mention Hillary Clinton and her mm-hmm. describing herself as a progressive during the 2016 campaign, what would be, you know, because this has been thrown around a lot, blame has been thrown all over, really all over the place at almost every conceivable corner of the political world for how Trump got elected, for how Hillary lost the election. One of the main, most pointed arguments that has been coming from the Democratic Party, or, you know, their propaganda wing, MSNBC and what have you, has been that it is the quote-unquote intolerant left that were were really to blame for her defeat, and for not supporting her once Bernie was out of the primary and things like that. What would you say? What's your response to those who blame the left, you know, the true left, or, you know, the progressive movement, whatever you'd want to call it, for the problems we're now dealing with under Trump?
I think that's a bunch of BS. 1% of people, I think it was, voted for Jill Stein.
Right.
Bernie Sanders activated voters who had never voted before. The Democratic Party establishment is not able to do that because they don't stand for anything besides we're not Trump.
Right.
You know, and Trump is awful. He's terrible. It's frightening living day to day under a Trump presidency. But he is a symptom of the capitalist machine that has been raging on for generations. These neoliberal policies that the Democratic Party has pushed for decades, exactly, has created this situation, not the left.
Right. One thing that, you know, has become more and more clear to me recently is that it strikes me when there was so much outcry and so much frustration and sadness after the day after the, you know, on November 9th or whatever it was, the day after the election. Mm-hmm. It occurs to me that a lot of people may have really just been woken up on that day, mm-hmm, to the failings of our system and to the larger plight of, you know, the American people and American working class more specifically, and to the different, you know, all the different things that have really come out of the last year and a half, whether it be the complete oppression of the police towards minority communities, you know, the ridiculousness of our legal system and how unfair it is and unjust. All the other things that have come out of that, it really is that people seem to have been woken up to that only because of the election of Trump, and may not have been aware of that during the Obama era, where those problems still existed, and they existed for you know, the better part of this last century. And it really was that people were lulled into this sense of security because you had a clean, you know, a shiny front on the political scene, you know, mm-hmm, whether even, you know, obviously Bush was a bumbling fool, but at least traditions were kept and appearances were made and things were made to look as if the system was functioning normally.
Exactly. It's all about, you know, norms and decorum.
Exactly.
And now that Trump has thrown that out the window, they have finally realized that these policies are bad, but these policies have been in effect for decades.
Right. And yeah, you know, that inevitably leads to the debate of, like, who do we blame for this? Oh, let's look at, you know, the people who were agitating for these issues before the election, who may have had some sort of, you know, what they call purity tests and things like that, mm-hmm, who actually stood on principles and may have spoken out against not only the insane Republican ticket, but, you know, also the people that the Democratic Party were putting up.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it is not surprising that blame has been thrown almost exclusively, it seems, at the left. But it does seem to stem from the fact that most people were not even aware of these issues before then.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just moving on, because we have about 10 minutes left here. How, you know, just to give a little background of where you come from and how you came to be the co-chair of the DSA here in Portland, how did you get involved in politics? How did you find yourself realizing you identify as a Democratic Socialist?
Well, I grew up in rural Ohio, a town of 7,000 people. I was the only Arab kid for miles and miles. And I think that sort of gave me a sort of natural inclination to the left. I mean, especially after 9/11, I was in fourth grade when that happened. And when you have classmates calling you a terrorist, you know, you wake up real fast and realize what politics are.
Yeah.
But as I grew up, I saw the two-party system, and I was never given an alternative to that. No one was ever given an alternative to that. It's
right.
The Democrats and the Republicans, and especially being Arab, you know, I work a lot now on Palestinian human rights. So that has always pushed me further to the left than Democrats, because all the Democrats are absolutely terrible. They're always, you know, absolutely unconditionally supporting Israel. So I guess I was like, well, this is the best we're going to get, you know? The Democrats aren't perfect on everything. I guess we just have to settle for that. It never occurred to me that there was anything else until Bernie Sanders ran his campaign and was using the words Democratic Socialism. And then I learned about this organization with the same name, the Democratic Socialists of America. And I think that's what happened with a lot of people. And DSA just totally blew up after Bernie's campaign and after especially after Trump got elected.
Right.
So, yeah, it was really Bernie Sanders who introduced me to the concept of democratic socialism. And now I would say Bernie is, you know, the bare minimum of what is acceptable. Not even. Like, he's said some really terrible things lately. but from joining DSA, I learned about, you know, I learned about so much more. I learned about this entire system. I learned about the system of capitalism and how we have been lied to, that not only is capitalism the only system, but that it's a good one. That's what we've been taught.
Right. Yeah, it is striking to me that, you know, people, the accepted concept was that Bernie, yeah, he may do well in the Democratic primary, but once in the general election, that S word there would just sink him. And, you know, to be perfectly frank, the opposite has happened over the last year and a half. I mean, just based on the growth of your organization and the acceptance of the term socialism, you know, people under 35, this poll came out a few years ago, but people under 35 actually identify more or are more in favor of the term socialism than they are with capitalism.
Totally.
I think it has a lot to do. I mean, obviously, there's a lot to thank for the folks who were involved in the Occupy movement back in 2011. But just the concept that even the term capitalism was really taboo until, I suppose, you know, the last 8-9 years, where it was, you know, people, we didn't even have the language to describe what we were living in. And I think that really comes down to the complete destruction of any structures on the left, you know, following the New Deal. I mean, really, you know, from the Progressive Era on, but specifically in the second half of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, where you have just this all-out consolidated attack on the left and on the language of the working class and the language of socialism and of, you know, labor organizing, things like that, so that we didn't even have the terms to describe the system we were living in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the thing about DSA is we, like you said, we people have this feeling that something is wrong, and we have finally given them the tools to understand what that something is. We have given them the words to describe it. I think that people base their politics off the correct inclination that the system is rigged. It's who is doing the rigging that they get wrong. You know, that's why there are so many conspiracy theorists and stuff like that. And that's why, you know, that's why the ruling class tells people that it's migrants that are taking their jobs. It's people on welfare that are sucking all the public benefits. It's the ruling class that has rigged the system for themselves and turned us all against one another and making us think that, you know, that we have to compete for this one little slice of pie when actually there's plenty for everyone.
Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, that's so very clearly characterized in the fact that a lot of the things that became Trump's general election platform were concepts, you know, very vague sort of platitudes towards these concepts, but that came from the Bernie Sanders campaign of, you know, ending the unfair trade deals and things like that. And so it's very clear that, you know, those ideas, when presented without context or when presented without the ideology behind it, are actually really appealing to the American people. And it's, you know, so when given an opportunity to vote for that, obviously there are a lot of other connotations that came with the Trump campaign, but those specific things did resonate with people. And so it seems pretty clear that given the opportunity to vote for a true version of what would be democratic socialism, or even just, you know, the basic Keynesian ideas of, like, welfare state, or however you know, social democracy, however you want to call it, those things resonate with the American people, and given a chance to vote for that, people would.
Mm-hmm.
But we are never given a chance to vote for that, and so you have what happens now, where people get caught up with a charlatan.
Yeah.
So just moving along a little bit here, how would you, you know, this is a criticism, or not a criticism, but a point that is often thrown back in rebuttal to folks who do advocate for socialism or, you know, any of the policies that we've been talking about here. What would you say to folks who say, well, has socialism ever worked around the world? You know, and they immediately, of course, turn to places like Venezuela or Cuba or the Soviet Union. What would be your rebuttal to saying, well, see, it didn't work there, so it can never work ever?
I think it did work in Cuba. They have a much higher life expectancy than us.
Right.
They have much better education. They have much better healthcare, much better research systems. Of course, it's not perfect. There are certainly, like, you know, it's not totally democratic. It's certainly had repressive elements. But,
right.
I mean, what about capitalism? Has capitalism worked? I don't think it has. I think it's failing the majority of people. So yeah. Just because, you know, leaders espouse a certain ideology or co-opt, you know, socialism for their own gains in certain countries, doesn't mean that we can't try it here. And especially in places like Venezuela and many other countries, you know, a large part of their instability is due to United States imperialism.
Absolutely.
So that's not a fair criticism, really.
Yeah, and it is such a strange argument to throw back. You know, it only, kind of going back to what we were saying before, it only works because of the lack of historical knowledge or understanding or just basic education about the system we live in, or the, you know, the sort of darker side of American history, that argument can work. Well, Venezuela, look at Venezuela now, only in this moment, don't think about the history of it, therefore it doesn't work. When, yeah, I mean, if it didn't work, you know, in their eyes in Cuba, well, then what about the countless examples of capitalist dictatorships or, you know, I mean, just things like people not having clean water in Flint, Michigan. Like, what about the failings of this system that we never point to?
The big thing that I get on Twitter from the communism tweet that was on Tucker Carlson was communism has killed 100 million people. First of all, that's including the 25 million people who were killed by the Nazi invasion of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, how many people has capitalism killed?
Right.
More people than 100 million, probably in a year.
I mean, if you look at our healthcare system, just that individual thing alone, that one silo within our society alone, has probably done more damage to the American population than, well, I can't compare it to necessarily the losses in World War II, but it definitely has been a massive killer, and we can't even have a reasonable conversation about the flaws within our healthcare system. I mean, just recently, I know someone who was in Europe and got in an accident, and spent some time in the hospital, has been recovering, and the medical bill for a few days stay in the hospital, for all the tests that have been run, for the medicine, for, you know, the equipment that has come with it, rounded up to about $5,000 before their insurance kicked in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's total for in a European social democracy, versus what it, I mean, I believe an ambulance ride is like minimum $1,000 or something like that in this country. So, you know, there needs to be context brought to that discussion, and it often is not.
Yeah. Did you hear the story about a woman who was just like run over by a train?
Yes, I did.
And she was telling all the bystanders, don't call an ambulance. Right. I can't afford it.
Yeah. Like, can you imagine having your leg trapped between the platform and the train, you know, whatever pain, the excruciating pain that would come with that. And the first thought is, oh my God, please do not call the help that I need, because I can't afford that. And it will literally be worse for me than this situation right now. So we, as always, are running out of time here. With the minute we have left, can you just give folks who are interested in what you've been discussing here a way to get in touch with you or with the organization, how to get involved?
Absolutely. Our website is portlanddsa.org. You can find our social media there, our calendar with all of our upcoming events. We have a super exciting event coming up this Friday. Tim Faust, who's a well-known DSA member who talks about the Medicare for All movement, is coming to talk to us this Friday. You can find more information on our website.
That's great. Well, you know, thank you so much for taking the time to be here. I know that there's a lot of work to be done, and so I appreciate you coming into the studio with me. Again, my guest has been the co-chair of the Democratic Socialist of America chapter here in Portland, Olivia Catby Smith. Thank you so much. I have been Michael Cathcart, your host. Have a great evening.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KABU has a tent set up at the Occupy ICE encampment in southwest Portland, where we are broadcasting and webcasting live reports from the camp.
Protesters have created a community of resistance since June 17th to protest the deportation and separation of families by the U.S.
U.S. Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE.
ICE, check our website for a schedule of upcoming broadcasts and listen to our past interviews at kboo.fm/OccupyICE.
Radio is proud to co-sponsor Pass the Mic on Friday, July 20th from 6:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Franklin High School in Portland. Pass the Mic aims to decrease isolation and find ways to connect youth, to carve out their own expressive safe space, and to share it in their own creative terms. This five-day music camp culminates in a closing concert by the Immigrant and Refugee Youth Campers, featuring their bands and performances created during the week. Again, that's Pass the Mic on Friday, July 20th from 6:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Franklin High School, 5405 Southeast Woodward Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Baby, you understand me now.
Hi, greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We are here with Antonio Zamora, icebreaker with the Temporary Autonomous Zone, the TAZ, calling for the abolition of ICE. ICE stands for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Of course, here on Prison Pipeline, we talk about the prison industrial complex, abolishing ICE, you know, as it's all related. And we're going to flesh all of that out here. And